So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about evolution in the laboratory, and I'm going to tell you, if we get to the end, hopefully about three different experiments. All of this is very much work in progress, so I will tell you exactly where we are and things about where we hope to be. But I thought that I would begin with perhaps the most important question, which is why? Why study evolution? And it seems to me that there are three answers. So the first is that by studying evolution, we might learn more about the constraints that evolution places on the structure and function of biological systems, and knowledge about those constraints, at least in principle, might help reveal to us or understand why they exist, general principles in biology. And it also should give us information that will help us with the specific explanation of particular systems that we evolve. So that even if you ask very general questions about evolution, and I'll talk in a second about the difference between what I think of as general and specific questions about evolution, even if you ask very general questions, you have to ask them about some specific part of biology. You have to impose a selective pressure, and so there's the chance you will learn something about the process that you're evolving. I would argue that it is one of the best tests of the idea of modularity that I talked about on Monday. If modules truly are collections of molecules that exist within the cell to serve a specific function, which is how I would define modules, which is a little bit different from the definition that Adam used yesterday, I might be tempted to take the definition that what Adam was calling a module and call it a motif or something like that. But I think it's important to just point out what the difference is. If this idea is right, then it should be true if you evolve some specific function, you apply selective pressure to do something like grow better in very low glucose concentrations, that the mutations you find should exist in a module that can be defined in independent ways, like the ones that Nama Bakay talked about, that those mutations should lie primarily within a single module and not be distributed over a large number of different modules, because otherwise, at least in the terms I'm interested in it, this idea doesn't carry much water. Okay. And since modularity is both a word that different people define differently, and in the sense I define it, it's debatable whether it's a concept that's true or not, a network appears to be, in some senses, less so. I'll say that the other thing that you can learn is about network structure, function, and mechanism. And in some sense, this really overlaps with that. But again, I just want to be specific. Okay. And there are two sorts of questions that we're interested in asking in the lab. And I'll give you examples of both. So the first is very general questions about evolution, things that have been widely debated in the community of people who work on evolution. So, and the example I'll give of that is why we have sex, and I'll talk more about why that's even a question. And we're not talking in particularly anthropomorphic terms here. And the second type of question is much more specific. It's about what happens when you try and do something to a particular module, right? And there's always some interrelationship between these questions. That is, the general questions have to be asked by applying selective pressure on particular functions. The specific questions, as well as giving you information about things that go on within a particular module or network, may well give you information that applies to general questions. But you might ask, well, why use evolution as a way of studying a particular network? And the analogy I would give you is what geneticists do. is they break networks. And from the broken networks, they try and figure out how the unbroken network worked. And I think it's at least a defensible argument that bending a network and so that you alter its function, figuring out how the bent network achieves a slightly different function might be at least as powerful a way of figuring out how the unperturbed network works. Okay, so how do people study evolution? And this actually is one of the reasons that we got interested in this field, is one of the ways that people study evolution is by theory, much more so with the possible exception of neurobiology than any other branch of biology. So there are mathematically well-worked out theories, the whole field of population genetics, which I gave at least an introduction to some of the equations from on Monday. And so there ought to be real interplay between theory and experiment, and because it's mathematically at least somewhat developed, it should be a productive area to collaborate with people like physicists and computer scientists. Now, there are the obvious limitations to theory, that if theory is not connected to experiment, it can go off in a little closed loop that ends up having relatively little to do with the real world. And there would certainly be evolutionary biologists of the verbal argument school, what's sometimes called the Oxford School, that includes people like Dawkins, who would take that view quite strongly. And there's strong debate amongst different classes of theoretical biologists, the people who model in words but try very hard to keep biology in mind. And even though people like Hamilton used equations, I think the ideas came from words. And the very strict mathematical school of population biology that comes from Fisher and is sometimes now called the Stanford School because of people like Marcus Feldman. The second method is through reconstruction. That is looking at the real world and trying to reconstruct what happened in evolution, initially from fossils, and now probably even more powerfully from looking at DNA sequences. So the DNA sequences in some sense provide a record at least of some of the things that have happened in evolution. And last, and at least until very recently, clearly least, is laboratory experiments. And so the obvious question is, and so there are two issues here. One is, can you study evolution in a laboratory period? I mean, we're accustomed to thinking to it as being a process that goes on over billions of years, and that's not the lifetime of the average PhD. And the second possibility, and I'll assure you that we can get around that problem. The second concern is, how relevant is what you study in the laboratory to what happens in the real world and what's happened over a billion year timescale? And the answer is, that's a hotly debated question, particularly between evolutionary biologists who study things in the field and those who study things in the laboratory. And I would just leave things by saying, just understanding how it works in the laboratory seems to me an interesting end in its own right. And at the very, very least, it ought to give us clues about what might have happened in the real world. And there are certainly things that we can do to test how extrapolable, in some sense, things in the laboratory are to the real world. And let me just give you an example of that. Obviously, the time scales are very different. It is also probably true that, in general, rates of mutation have been quite different, that the intensity of selection has been quite different, and effective population sizes have been quite different. Right? So that I'll just remind you again that the effective population size of the human population is 10 to the fourth, which is related to what its size was in the relatively recent past. Sorry, the estimates of the effective population size of humans. With microorganisms, you can achieve, without too much work, effective population sizes of 10 to the ninth in the laboratory, so that differs by five orders of magnitude. You can increase the mutation frequency by three orders of magnitude, and you can apply extremely strong selective pressure. Now, if it was true that the rate of evolutionary change was in some sense proportional to the product of the effective population size, the selective pressure and the mutation rate, you can imagine that you are effectively speeding up evolution by many orders of magnitude relative to the quote-unquote real world, and therefore a year in the laboratory could equal a million years in the real world. Now, those arguments are quite tenuous, but what you can do in laboratory experiments, and we're starting experiments, a physics student named Michael Desai, who's working jointly with me and Dan Fisher and David Nelson, is starting experiments to try and ask, as you vary those parameters, what happens to evolution? So we can at least ask, when you vary things over that parameters, do you dramatically affect how evolution works? If you don't, if all you're doing is affecting the rate and not the types of changes that you accumulate, then I think the argument that we can compress time in a sense, real-world time, so that we can study things in the laboratory, becomes a much stronger one, and at least it's a falsifiable proposition, because if as we change those parameters, the mode of evolution starts to be dramatically different. We go, well, sorry, it's just relevant to things in the laboratory. Yes. No, I did this in chalk in the hope that I could be interrupted even more than I was on Monday, which would seem difficult. But. Well, I'm going to talk in a second about how you would study it in the laboratory. We're going to talk about yeast.
Okay, for someone like myself who works on multicellular animals, I'm already working on yeast, but we can come back to that in a moment. The real point that we're worrying is that if I think about multicellular organisms, they are, as we all say, highly canonized. And so when you try to do an evolutionary experiment now, you're ignoring the fact that they have evolved in order not to.
Well, I see the assertion. I think it would be an interesting thing to talk at more length about in the discussion. So what Lewis is talking about, so canalization robustness, call it what you will, refers to the fact that there are large aspects of the biology of organisms that appear to be quite strongly resistant to environmental perturbation and genetic perturbation. It is again a debated point whether that robustness or canalization exists to defend primarily against environmental variation, to defend against genetic variation, or possibly, and again this is something we could talk about, as a way in a sense of possibly, it will sound paradoxically now, but I'd rather talk about it later, in a sense possibly actually facilitating evolution. But just in reference to what you're saying, I mean, one thing you'll be happy to know is our largest ambition is to evolve multicellularity in yeast, so then you might be more interested in that. And the second thing to say is that yeast is at least as strongly canalized as development is. Yeah, I mean, it's very robust to all sorts of perturbations. So we will be dealing with that problem. Okay? That's all right.
What are the time scales for generation that you can reasonably expect?
In our experiment?
Well, in various experiments, for various organisms. For example, is a multicellular organism any chance to do with evolution?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that in a second. I'm going to give a list of the organisms that people use for experiments like this, and I'll mention their lifespans or their reproductive cycles. Yes. How do you know that? How do you know that? Give me the evidence behind that assertion.
Because if you look in the fossil record of what are the main causes of big changes on what's swimming and crawling around on this earth, it's not the kind of selection pressure that you can entertain in the laboratory, right? You don't throw meteorites at them or completely change the chemical composition of the atmosphere in the laboratory. Or have things like that happen to you?
Well, but I think it's okay. So just since you use the word preposterous, and without in any sense wishing to be confrontational, because you use it in a very polite way, I think it's equally preposterous to argue that we know enough about evolution in any sense to make assertions about what really drove. I mean, we know that changes in geochemistry drove evolution, but to make the argument that in some sense that's fundamentally different from a selective pressure you might apply in the laboratory, it's not clear to me that you can do that. So let's say we evolved yeast so that it used octane as a carbon source, right? Now, I would say that might correspond to a rather profound change in geochemistry, right? Now, we're not particularly planning on doing it. I mean, I think the other thing that I would say, and I guess, you know, this may put me in some confrontation with Lewis, is there are different sorts of biologists at some level. I mean, I think Lewis and I are both probably rather broadly interested in biology. I primarily care to know how cells work, because I take the position that it's harder for me to understand how a cell works than to understand how development works. That given cells, you can explain development. And obviously, everyone has their personal choice. And so I'm sort of interested in how you put systems together to do things and how they interact with each other. And it's my guess that we can do things in the laboratory where we can put things under very strong pressure to do things that are really quite novel. Now, will we be able to recreate the Cambrian explosion? No, and I'm not particularly interested in doing it. But I think you're making an assertion which is an interesting point to debate. But I don't see it as there being a weight of evidence on your side. And if you think there is, you should straighten me out.
It's kind of clear. If evolution is an enormously widely defined thing, right? If you say evolution, you haven't constrained your dynamics at all. You can do many things. You can introduce space. You can introduce interaction between populations. You can have sex. You can have no sex. And if you just play games with these kind of things in a computer, you can already see that you can have entirely different results and entirely different.
But we don't know that that's true. But the difference is the experiments in computers don't incorporate the constraints of what goes on in cells, because we don't know what those cells are. We at least are doing things with cells. I mean, you could have made the argument. Let's say you went to Jacob and Monod and André Loif and you said, "You people are nuts. You're studying, you know, the metabolism of this stupid sugar. How do you expect to learn the first thing in general about gene regulation? I mean, you know, this is metabolic. What would this have to do with development?" So on and so forth. And, you know, I would ask the developmental biologist in our midst whether he believes that through the general principles that Jacob and Monod and Loif elicited, we learned something about that's been very helpful in understanding development. I hope to God Lewis is going to say yes, right? And so I'm perfectly happy to admit that I may go to my grave having piddled around in some backwater that has nothing to do with how evolution really works, but I'm certainly sort of benignly confident that no one can demonstrate to me right now that that's indubitably going to be true.
How evolution really works. You suggest that there is some specific answer to the question, but it's similar to asking, like, how do differential equations really work?
But it's an untested assertion, right? Your assertion is that that's true. My assertion is that that's not. My assertion is that the constraints of biology are sufficiently strong that by doing things in the laboratory, we will learn things about evolution, and evolution is sufficiently constrained so that it can't be done in all that many different ways in biological systems, and what we learn will be relevant to how evolution has gone on in the world. Now, that's an untested assertion. If it turns out to be false, you know, I won't jump off a bridge.
Can I be very provocative?
Well, I just fail to see how we could get any less provocative, but let's try.
First of all, I kind of agree with you. You see, from the point of view of evolution, once
That's the first time this week, by the way.
From the point of view of evolution, the really miracle is the eukaryotic cell, or like the bacterial cell, but the eukaryotic cell. I intend to go to my grave and perfectly hung, shined, and showed me that once you had the eukaryotic cell, it was downhill all the way. The only thing that happens in evolution is that the gene changes, and that changes the proteins of the cell. That's it. Now, there may be interactions and all things, but ultimately, that's all. If you're looking for a principle, that's the Darwinian principle. There is nothing else. Yes, it's a bit complicated with population, but ultimately, we're interested in going from genotype to phenotype. What the environment selects is phenotype.
Yeah, and I would not demur from that statement.
The only thing that matters is the cell.
The evolution. So perhaps you're not studying the evolution of embryos exploding. But forget this word. How about just studying adaptive, heritable changes in response to...
I think there is... Adaptation is something which we see every day with resistance to antibiotics or resistance of mosquitoes to DDT or whatever. And I think it's maybe a question which I don't think there's a lab experiment, speciation.
We're going to talk about speciation in the laboratory.
Okay.
Yeah, well, can I make a suggestion? And Boris can veto this. I'm perfectly happy to spend the next hour, you know, having a general discussion. But if we're going to have a discussion as well, you know, and people like David Benzeman are interested in questions about, like, what's the lifespan of these various organisms, which we can answer rapidly, that maybe we can raise the philosophical questions for the discussion and things where, you know, I have once or twice said, oh, yeah, you're right. Ten to the fourth comes what you can estimate, what population genetics claims it can estimate accurately, is the product of the effective population size and the mutation rate. It can't actually measure either of those individually. They're independent estimates of the mutation rate, so you can then do the appropriate division and you get to this number. I am not sufficiently well versed in the theory of population genetics that I'm particularly well able to critique this number to tell you my personal belief about how many orders of magnitude the slop is. But I doubt it's more than one or two. Yes?
I want to say something concrete that I just follow the staff, and you might, during your talk, say something about, is that you kind of said that you thought you would see evolution corresponding with modularity in the lab. And one of the things I just was wondering about was if you suppose that you have a lot of protocols of modularity in order to have robustness, not so much for efficiency. So if you take an automobile and it would evolve in the lab by mutation efficiency, because you need to do, it would get less modular. Because you would put it into circumstances which needed very little of the robustness for which it was actually designed, the engineer really designed it. And therefore, you start wiring stuff up in all sorts of baroque and complicated ways to squeeze out a little more efficiency. But then the car would work less well out in the real world.
I think that's an interesting point.
Look at parasites. You can see the process of evolution. And you can find parasites where they're starting to lose functionality, and they're starting to get rewired.
I think that's a good point, and I think that is a real worry about some of these experiments. That is, that for simplicity, what we tend to do is put cells uninterruptedly in a particular selective pressure. And so there are two things that will happen. You will break modules that you don't need, and there's lots of evidence for that. If Radman had come here, he would have told you about that. It's an interesting question that I don't think we know the answer to,
I think either answer is interesting,
and it does suggest that it would be worth thinking about and quite possibly doing experiments where one uses environments that change and fluctuate in a way that much more mimics what might happen in the real world. And I think that's actually, that's a potent statement of a way in which these experiments might do a poor job of mimicking the real world.
No, but it's interesting.
It's still, I think it's still interesting.
If you put it in a very simple environment, it modularly starts breaking down.
No, I agree with you, that either, and it's an excellent point to make.
So if the bugs start breaking on their own systems, in a very benign environment, that answers it.
Yeah. Okay.
We know that happens.
All right. I promise never to give an introduction again. okay. So the question is, what organisms can this be done with? So it's been done with phage, which had the, well, actually, it's been done with RNA, so that people like Jack Szostak and others evolve RNA molecules in the laboratory to have specific function. And people have done it with coupled RNA protein systems like Manfred Eigen with Q-beta replicase. It's been done with bacteriophage. It's been done with bacteria, yeast. CE stands for worms, Caenorhabditis elegans, Drosophila melanogaster, the fruit fly. And these are listed in terms of increasing life cycle time. So this is 20 minutes. This is 20 minutes for doubling. These guys, it's hard to ascribe a doubling time to because they do more than double. This is 90 minutes. This is 3 days. And this is, what's fly? It's about 10. Okay. So that gives you a sense of the time scales. So what it means is that a lot of the there's been a lot of work done in flies. A lot of that work has probably primarily selected on variation that pre-exists within population more than the appearance of new mutations. And it's also true that as the organisms get bigger, not only is the generation time getting longer, but because they're bigger, the effective population sizes that you can maintain go down just because, you need a football field to keep them in.
Natural evolution of some mice which invaded some island, I think it was in the Azores, that suddenly occupied two different valleys and developed to be two different species within a few hundred years.
Yeah, and that's certainly part. I mean, there is.
Is this reasonable to imagine?
So there's. Yes, and so there are examples. I mean, since the question's been raised, there are examples from the real world of very fast evolutionary change. So the acquiring of DDT resistance, antibiotic resistance in bacteria has all happened within human lifetimes. There's the classical example about the peppered moth in industrial England, which was primarily white before the Industrial Revolution. Tree trunks became black. The population became black by fixing a melanic mutation. And then in the latter half of the 20th century, with pollution control, the trees became white again and the population switched back. In terms of speciation, there are things where, like the example you described, which involves human introduction, there are also things that have to do with the advance and retreat of glaciers, which depopulate lakes, for example, and then allow them to be repopulated. And there are examples of fish where within timescales like 10 to the 4th years, actually within a single lake, speciation has occurred. And perhaps the most compelling example of all is that Lake Victoria 10,000 years ago was a little muddy river. And then through geological movements, it became a large lake. And the evidence from DNA sequences, there was a single species of cichlid fish living in that muddy river. There are today 400 such species. Well, there were 400 in 1930. They're down to about 250 now. But there are several hundred species that have clearly derived from this individual. And we'll talk about speciation later. All right. So the organism that we work on is budding yeast, and we do that for several reasons. It has a short doubling time. It has excellent genetics, and it is the best developed organism in terms of genomics. And one thing that the genomics is relevant to is in all these experiments like this that have been done historically, very few of them, except for the ones done on phage where you can afford in terms of time and money to sequence whole genomes, have made much effort to find the mutations that are responsible for the phenotypes because it's just been too hard. And genomics, at least in principle, gives us ways to do that. And in the unlikely event that we get to the end, I could even spend a couple of minutes talking to you about the, about ways that the actual mechanics of how you try and do that. Okay. And the other thing that's actually is a big advantage, so you could ask, why are we doing evolutionary experiments on budding yeast since it divides 4.5 times slower than E. coli? And there are two answers to that. There's the one that I was trained as a yeast geneticist, and it's easier to keep doing what you know how to do. More importantly is yeast has sex that's recognizably the same in all its fundamentals as the way we do, and bacteria, although they exchange genetic information, do it in a way that is really rather unrelated, particularly if you think in an evolutionary sense, to what goes on in eukaryotes. And if one's interested in sex, then you should do it in a eukaryote. Okay. So this is the life cycle of budding yeast. It comes in two sexes, or mating types. They're called A and alpha. So you can have haploid cells, which are either A or alpha. It's the mating type is controlled by a single genetic locus. These cells can reproduce vegetatively. That is, the cells make little buds. When cell division occurs, the mother and the daughter separate, and they can both go around this cycle again, and they can do so indefinitely. The two cells communicate with each other by secreting a peptide pheromone, which they have the opposite mating type. So these guys secrete something called A factor, and these guys have receptor for A factor, and that induces the activity of the pheromone signaling pathway that Nama talked about in some detail. But this is why that pathway actually exists. The cells communicate with each other. They sense gradients. There is another renegade physicist working in the lab who's actually interested in the theory of gradient detection, but we don't really have time to talk about that. And as a result of sensing those gradients, the cells polarize towards each other to make these things called schmooze. The schmooze fuse with each other, goes through the charmingly named Mexican hat stage, where the hat's drawn upside down here, where this fused cell produces a bud, and that bud can go through a cell cycle that looks very much like the haploid cell cycle, except these cells are diploid. Okay, so you have alternation of haploidy and diploidy. And again, it's these cells, as long as you leave them in rich medium, can go around this cycle indefinitely. However, if you starve them for nitrogen and you place them on a non-fermentable carbon source like acetate or ethanol, they undergo a differentiation pathway, sporulation, and they go through meiosis. They make four haploid spores, of which two are A and two are alpha. If you return those spores to rich medium, they germinate and put you back into the haploid part of the cell cycle. So the nice thing is you can grow the cells either as haploids or diploids, and you can control whether or not they have sex by whether you keep the A's and the alphas separated from each other. Okay. Yes? They're pretty similar, but diploids have the upper hand in the standard medium that's used in the laboratory. I don't know how carefully it's been looked at in other growth conditions. The assumption is that diploids will always have the advantage because we know embarrassingly little about the natural history of yeast compared to fruit flies or worms, and it's actually quite an important deficit in our knowledge. All evidence suggests that when spores germinate, they become diploid very rapidly. There's a thing that called mating type switching, where an A cell can give rise to daughters that have switched mating type. And so the small initial colony that grows from a spore can very easily, at least in wild yeast strains, can very easily make diploids again. So all the yeast that anyone's ever found in the wild are diploid. And so the assumption is that this whole process is set up so that the cells exist primarily as diploids, and it's just a sort of trick of doing things in the laboratory, if you like, that you can grow them indefinitely as haploids. It's certainly true if you starve them for carbon, they won't sporulate, right? They'll just stop dividing. I'm sure more is known about it than I know, so I just don't know the answer to your question. I think it's true that as long as you keep nitrogen levels high, you inhibit the sporulation process. So I think it is somewhat specific. It is true that the environment in, so what is known about the natural history of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the particular budding, I mean, there are lots of budding yeast, but the one that when scientists say budding yeast, they mean, which is the Baker's or Brewer's yeast, is it has lived for a long time in cohabitation with humans, and the small group of salts who work on the natural history have a fierce debate amongst their own community whether it is in fact an obligant attachment to human culture. And the place where we know anything about its natural history, it gets introduced into grapes by physical damage. So the bloom you see on the surface of grapes is not Saccharomyces cerevisiae. It gets introduced either because the things swell osmotically and burst, or more probably in the real world, by insects that carry it on their mouth parts. In a vineyard, about one in every 200 or 300 grapes has Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And they have less Saccharomyces cerevisiae than they do many other species of microbes when the grapes get crushed by machine or the feet of peasants. Saccharomyces is in the minority in the population, but it has a property, unlike most microorganisms, that presented with glucose, instead of oxidizing it, which produces 38 ATPs per glucose, it ferments it, which produces only two, but it produces two things, acetic acid and ethanol. And of common microflora, Saccharomyces cerevisiae is the only thing that can grow above a certain concentration of both acetic acid and ethanol. And in fact, there's a race between it and a bacterium called Acetobacter. Acetobacter primarily makes acetic acid, and if you make enough acetic acid, it wins, which is why if you do natural fermentation in wineries, which many wineries still do, there is a chance you will make vinegar instead of wine, which is why many wineries introduce yeast. And amusingly, the people, one of whom is a guy called Duccio Cavalieri, who's one of the fellows of the Genome Center at Harvard, if you go in and look in the final results of fermentation in wineries where they introduce yeast, usually the thing that's left at the end is not the yeast they introduced, but it's something that came with the grapes. Anyway, that's all a bit of a digression. So what happens is during fermentation, it's nitrogen limited. And so the nitrogen levels rapidly become very low. Things don't probably sporulate during standard fermentation because it becomes quite anoxic. But eventually what happens is everything gets tipped out, and all the stuff that's particulate, which includes the yeast, gets tipped out in the fields, and that's probably where the things sporulate. And it's an interesting, it would be an interesting question to know how much phosphate is in grape juice. Okay. So I'm going to describe actually in some detail how a typical experiment is done. And so what we do is we take two strains, which we've marked with different drug resistance markers. And there's some difference between those strains that we're interested in terms of evolutionary behavior. And the one I'll start by talking about, which is simply a repetition of an experiment that people like first Jeffrey Miller and then Miroslav Radman and his colleagues have done many times in bacteria. So we're not doing anything novel or original or even possibly particularly interesting here. but it's a convenient introduction. It's to ask, what is the effect of increasing the mutation frequency? The mutation frequency in wild-type cells is about 10 to the minus 9th per base pair per cell per generation, which means if you look at an individual base pair, you have to go through on average 10 to the 9th cells before you see a 10 to the 9th cell divisions before you see a mutation at that base pair. Okay? Because one of the things, if you read about evolutionary biology, people talk about mutation frequency all the time, and you need to look carefully to see what they're talking about, because they could be talking about mutation frequency per base pair, which is what it is here, mutation frequency per gene, and evolutionary population geneticists are particularly atrocious in this regard, because they often mean frequency of advantageous or disadvantageous mutations, and that's almost always a completely unknown and inferred quantity, so you have to be a bit careful. Yeah, that would be the argument. And so, and that's the same mutation, well, that's the mutation frequency per cell per generation in humans, since to go from the sperm and egg that your father and mother provided to, in your case, the sperm that you would contribute to a child, is about on the order of a further something like 30 generations. The frequency per base pair per human generation rather than per cell division is about 10 to the minus 8. So given that our population now is about 10 to the 10th, every individual point mutation is present in at least 100 different people, even if it wasn't present a generation ago. And there are mutators. You can increase mutation frequency genetically in a variety of ways. You can affect the proofreading activity of DNA polymerase. It's more commonly done by inactivating mismatch repair, which is the mechanism that deals with the mistakes that are left over even after proofreading. And a typical mutator will increase this frequency to about 10 to the minus 7. And you can ask, well, what's the effect of that? So the way we do the experiment is we take two different strains. They can be, it's your choice, they can be haploid or diploid. The experiments I'll describe were done with diploids. And they're marked with these two different drug resistance markers. You put them in the medium that is going to apply the selective pressure. And over 24 hours, this population increases from 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 8th by cell division. You then take 1/100th of the volume of this culture and you re-inoculate it into a fresh tube. And poor souls who do these experiments come in every day for weeks and months and do that. And it's an interesting question about whether you can find ways of keeping people from doing that. And there is a device called a chemostat that will do that. And there are questions about whether this thing, where the population shows these oscillations, right? So this is a logarithmic scale. So every time you dilute them, it takes a while for the cells to wake up and start dividing again. They divide exponentially. They run out of goodies. Whether this is a more realistic approximation to what might happen in the real world versus a chemostat, where the population is kept absolutely steady because a chemostat looks like this. In essence, I mean, one of the reasons we don't use chemostats is they tend to be large, relatively expensive devices, and if you want to do multiple experiments in parallel, and I'll explain in a second why, unfortunately, you need to do that, you run out of space and money quite quickly, although one of the things we're talking with experimental physicists about is trying to miniaturize chemostats, so you could get around this problem. What happens in a chemostat is there's a device for stirring the liquid. There are cells growing in the liquid. There's an out pipe, and there's an in pipe, and medium drips in. And since there's a pipe here, it also drips out. And by controlling the rate at which that happens, you effectively control the cell division rate, and you maintain a constant population in exponential growth. So you can go through many, 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 many generations growing exponentially. This is probably a very poor approximation to what happens in the real world, because at least things that divide every 90 minutes, by the time they've divided 100 times, you have in a real world situation where that was happening, that would be 2 to the 100th cells, which is not a reasonable number. Okay.
Uh,
No, I'm sure they are. It's another reason we don't do stuff. I mean, you know, and we are talking, we're talking, I mean, because having to dilute the cells every day is a very serious technical limitation. I mean, it's a pain in the ass too, but I mean. And so we're thinking about if we can miniaturize chemostats, and then we would have, if we can do that, then we have to test that we're not selecting for cells that stick to the side, because if we are, we're. Yeah, the yeast work in Jerry Fink's lab suggests that yeast can make biofilm-like things too. So yeah, so there are all those sorts of. Whereas in this situation, you can't do that. Okay. So then every so often, not every cycle, but every 5, 10, however many cycles, you care to. And I'll just point out that diluting it 1 to the 100th means that there are 6.7 cell doublings between generation. That is, 100 is 2 to the 6.7. You plate the cells out on rich medium. They grow into little colonies if you plate them out sufficiently dilute, and then you replica plate them. How many people here don't know what replica plating is? Okay, fantastic. You replica plate them either to drug one or drug two, and you count the number of colonies that grow up, because this tells you which of the cells are red and which of the cells are white. Again, in principle, there are other ways you could do that. For example, you could mark the different cells with different colored fluorescent proteins, and you could use something else to do the measurement, which might be less painful. And also, very importantly, accuracy counts here, because if you want to measure small differences in fitness, you depend on the statistics of these numbers, and you know, even if you played out 1,000 colonies, this is a Poisson distributed thing, so the standard deviation is the square root, so it's 30, and if you're interested in things that are on the order of 1%, you're sort of nailed at that point. Okay. All right. So here are the actual. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, exactly. It's just to take a measurement.
So you could do multiple ones if you're worried about the noise.
Yeah, but if you're the person, so let's say you have a typical experiment of the sort I'm going to describe has something like 60 cultures running in parallel, right? You can do accurate counting with about 200 cells on a plate, right? So if you want to count 1,000 cells per culture, that means you're doing 5 plates per 2 times 60 is 300 plates. So the people doing these experiments spend most of their time with a Sharpie and a colony counter, little clicker in their hand, banging up and down on plates, counting colonies.
You can't automate
that? Well, that's what I was just talking about. In principle, by doing things, yes, in principle you can, right? And we're investigating ways to do that. But the problem is that every time you make the measurement more indirect, you expose yourself to more possibilities of artifact, and you have to be very careful about doing things. I mean, the thing I would point out is, if the typical difference in fitness between two strains is on the order of 1%, it means it takes many generations to see effects, right? If the things that you've put in the strains to do the measurement affect their fitness, that is, they make them grow a little bit slower or faster, that artifact that you've introduced will dominate the experiment, right? You don't. But the thing is, I can explain why that doesn't help you. Okay.
But, sorry, I don't understand. Because you still have your population that is just evolving. So if you wait long enough, even with the 1%, it's going to take over the population. Don't see, even if you have.
No, not it. You've marked these two strains with different markers. If this has a fitness advantage of 1%, and no mutations have occurred yet in the culture, it will take over the culture. Let me explain this, because maybe this will help people think about it. We'll find a spare piece of space. Because we've inadvertently done this experiment several times. I mean, we didn't do it as an experiment. Well, it wasn't the experiment we were intending to do at the time. So here you start out. So you measure the relative abundance of the two strains on a log scale. Call this zero. It's easy to measure changes over two orders of magnitude in either direction. You start out with two strains that are genetically identical, except that you've marked them as being different. And you do an experiment. And there's some fluctuation, and then one of these guys takes over the culture. You go, bang, I didn't expect that. That's one culture. You look at the next culture, and so on and so forth, and you're like, what the hell is going on here? And it's easy to explain what's going on here. What happens is the population is subdivided into two pieces. In one of those two pieces, the advantageous mutation occurs first. So it starts to go up this hill. Now, there are two things that mean that this strain is almost certainly going to drive the other one to extinction. The first thing is there are now more red cells than white cells. If further mutations that will increase the fitness are equally likely to occur in the red or white cells, they're going to occur in the red cells more often because there are more of them. Those that are rich shall become richer. From the poor shall be taken away even that little which they have. Okay? The second thing that is true is, let's say this mutation causes a fitness increase of 1%. Okay? And now another mutation occurs which causes a fitness increase of 0.5%. If it occurs in the red population, the white population here, the red guys are going to be doing even worse than they were before. If it occurs in the red population, they're going to be losing less slowly than they were before, but they're still going to be losing. Okay? So basically, this is an unstable, to a physicist, this is a metastable situation, having a 50-50 distribution. And you do experiments, and so we have control experiments that we do where we don't expect either strain to win. And what happens is in half of the experiments, one strain wins, and in half of the experiment, the other strain wins. And that's the unfortunate and unbelievably annoying thing that requires us to do multiple replicates of the experiment. We're not mating. We're not doing any mating yet. No sex has yet occurred. Yeah, well, diploid cells don't mate. Okay, and haploid cells have one mating type. Yeah, they divide. Yeah, because you keep them in glucose and you keep the nitrogen levels high. Yeah, I swear to you, all those things can be controlled in a comfortable way. What? Yeah, you can have haploids and diploids.
No, I'm talking about the red and the white. You say always one.
I wouldn't like to swear up and down. I can't remember in any of the experiments that anyone's done in the lab where that's been a stable situation. Yes?
I still don't understand how this. I thought you were saying that you cannot measure 1% fitness advantage.
No, you can measure 1% fitness advantage. Fine. All I'm saying is you have to be exceedingly careful that anything you put into the strains that you're going to use to measure the fitness advantage of strains does not itself change the fitness of the strains. And that turns out, once you start talking about, 1%, 0.5% changes in fitness, that's hard to do.
I still don't understand, because the guys that you take out from the fitness measurement, just by seeing what the abundance is of the two types, that's not going to affect the dynamics of the guys.
No, but those have to have genetic markers in them. So that you can do the assay, right? The strains have to be genetically marked at the beginning of the experiment with things like these drug resistances that you're going to use to do the assay to tell who's winning and who's losing, right? And if those things, even in the... Got it? Okay. All right. So these experiments, this is a classical thing of having the hubris to go like, people aren't very good at doing this. We'll just come and clean this field up. And then you go like, oh yeah, these experiments are surprisingly hard. Lots of artifacts. Important to think clearly, and it's probably to learn a lot, probably to make technological innovations so that you can do this better. So, What we're trying to do now is to mark the cells with fluorescent proteins, use a cell sorter to do these periodic assays, because a cell sorter can sort 10 to the 6 cells per second, and you can, or 10 to the 5th per second, sorry. And you can, in principle, get a microtiter thing so that you can do a thing every 20 seconds, although an interesting issue is that carryover is a big deal in that problem, that in the sort of experiments that Jonathan Aaron doing, you know, 1% carryover is probably not killing them, but in these experiments between samples, that would nail you. Yes? They have precisely the same fitness, because when you do this sort of annoying supposedly control experiment where there should be neither winner nor loser, it is 50-50 distributed which one is the stochastic winner. And if that if those two strains had different relative fitnesses, that ratio should be biased from 50-50.
But you're saying you think that CFP versus YFP or something is going to have different
Well, the things that we've made look like they may not. But it's a little preliminary. All I'm trying to say is these experiments are, if we'd thought more carefully, they wouldn't have been surprisingly difficult. Since we didn't think very hard, they're surprisingly difficult. They're difficult, whether it's anticipable. Don't worry about it. I mean, I'm just talking about, you know, possibly improving the technology. Yeah. So again, you would have to check that you don't have fitness effects from doing that. But you could imagine, so in principle, you could, the yeast deletion pool is made, which is a collection of 4,800 strains where every non-essential gene has been deleted and replaced with an oligonucleotide barcode. You can do exactly these sort of experiments where instead of competing two strains, you're competing 4,800 and you read out their abundances. It turns out that those measurements are astonishingly noisy, right? And Adam actually knows a lot more about it than I do, and you have to do a lot of repeated measurements because there's a large standard error associated with the measurement of any one of those individual oligonucleotides, so we'd probably be doing even more repetitions than we're already doing. Yeah, in principle, absolutely. In practice, it's not clear that that would help us. Whatever is used for doing the stuff on the barcoded deletions is noisy. And the other thing you have to worry about is you want to be really, really sure that not only does the thing you use as the marker not affect fitness, but nothing that's likely to happen during evolution, including all the random mutations, because you can't just accumulate the good mutations, especially in asexual experiments, isn't going to affect the thing you're using to do the assays. And anything that involves measuring a quantitative as opposed to a qualitative parameter inside cells is terrifying in that regard. Okay? Okay. Yes? The replica plate, you can see that in doing it this way, doing this in an unbelievably painful way, has the advantage that it's very well controlled. If cells lost the marker, you would see it. And especially when you start doing things with mutators, you better worry about stuff like that. But you can calculate how often it should be. Even with mutators, it should be pretty rare. But yes, it's a good point. Okay. So here is an example of a typical experiment. So this experiment starts out with mutators and wild types. I guess preserve the color code. The mutators were red. And if the mutators win, the thing goes up. If wild type wins, it goes down. And these are single lines, but they're representative of multiple replicate experiments that have behaved the same way. And the difference between these two lines are the conditions under which the cells were repetitively grown. And these cells were grown in rich medium. And the fact the line goes down means the mutator's lost. And it goes down essentially as a straight line on a logarithmic scale like this. Right? One of the things that's worth pointing out from these experiments is if they were done sufficiently carefully and repeated sufficiently many times, there is probably a lot that could be gleaned by a combination of modeling and analysis of the detailed kinetics of these things. I will state, and it's very important that I state this emphatically, they have not been enough times and the measurements have not been made with enough precision that you should attempt to do that now. Okay? If you do the same thing in a medium to which cells are not particularly well adapted, for example, you use very low glucose concentrations, which is the condition that this guy Richard Lenski, who's been evolving populations of bacteria now for 20,000 generations, pegged. And David Botstein's lab has also done work like this in yeast. You can evolve cells to grow better in concentrations of glucose that are much lower than the ones that they've been habituated to for many, 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 many generations in the laboratory. And under these conditions, the mutators win. Okay? So that's in, I mean, it just, what? It's regular oxygen, which is, it's neither particularly high, it's not anoxic, and we're not bubbling oxygen through them. Yeah, and almost for sure. Well, they acquire some advantage pretty quickly. I don't know that they're acquiring the full-fledged Pasteur effect.
They do.
Yeah, okay, so but those experiments, I think, went on for more generations than ours. So. That's an interesting question, whether the you select for changing the mutation frequency or not. Someone in the lab has done an experiment where they propagated in rich medium for a very, very long time mutator strains. Partly, they were interested in what would happen. So the point here is that in medium to which cells are well adapted, most mutations are disadvantageous, and therefore it is bad to have the mutation frequency go up. In conditions where the cells are not necessarily particularly well adapted, most mutations are still deleterious. In fact, it is probably true that a higher fraction of the mutations are deleterious under these conditions than under these ones. Okay? But what is true is there are now some small number of mutations that are relatively strongly advantageous, and they are sufficiently strongly advantageous that even though most of these cells are getting mutations that are making them worse off than normal, a small minority get mutations that make them better off, and they do that more quickly than the wild-type cells. Yes, exactly. Right. In the long term, that should be true. These experiments haven't been carried out for very long. It's interesting in the Lenski experiments. So the Lenski experiments were started out with strains that were not mutators. They started 12 independent parallel lines. Three of those lines became mutators. Now that all happened at least long enough ago so that the Nature paper is at least 3 years old that described that. I know that the things are still being propagated every day, and so it would be an interesting question to ask whether the mutation frequency goes down. In the experiments that Rudman and his colleagues did where they put wild type and mutator strains into germ-free mice and collected mouse poop and saw who was winning and losing, what happened in that situation, two interesting things happened. When they did it with pure wild type cultures in at least one of the mice, they saw a mutator arising and dominating the population. And in the mutator cultures, in at least, I think, a couple out of 10 or so, they measured the mutation frequency at the end, and in a couple of them, it had gone down, not all the way to the wild type frequency. So yeah, so you're exactly right. In situations like this, you could expect that the organism itself will try and titrate the mutation rate. And in particular, if you ever run out of adaptation, and there's interesting questions about whether or not that ever happens, then it should be true that you start selecting against the mutator. And there are interesting questions about how long it takes to run out of adaptive mutations. And in the Lenski experiments, which have been going on now for what most of us would consider a pretty long time, the adaptation rate... What? Right, yeah. But all I'm saying is, but just looking in, not even worrying for a second about whether the populations are mutated, you look at the starting fitness of the strain, right? And this is time in generations, and this is 20,000 out here. What's happened is the strain's got fitter, and it looked like it was a straight line at first. And it's starting to tail off, but it's not flat yet. right? So, and then as it gets flatter, then you might expect mutators to have less of an advantage because a deleterious mutation should still occur at the same frequency and so on. Yes? Yes, that's true, and Rudman has a complicated story he spins about how he thinks they get it back. And one thing that's worth pointing out is there are situations in the natural world where the frequency, so you would expect the mutation frequency in a well-adapted, sorry, the mutator frequency in a well-adapted population to be very low. A frequency that is determined by the rate at which you make that mutation and its selective disadvantage. And you can do back of the envelope calculations, so this should suggest that should be 10 to the minus 4-ish. Okay? And then you can look in natural populations of bacteria and you can say, okay, what fraction are mutators? And so, for example, in soil bacteria, you see much higher frequencies of mutators than that, you know, 10%. In hospital isolates, a surprisingly high number of mutators, which is sort of terrifying. Okay, right, and in people who are, and perhaps the most telling example is there's a thing called Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is involved in infections in the lung. If you are a normal person, you occasionally get infected, you get a little sick, you recover. If you recover the bacterium from normal individuals, they're not mutators. People who have cystic fibrosis, where they basically have too much mucus in their lung, are continually infected with bacteria, including this one, and they are treated sequentially with one antibiotic after another after they become resistant to the first antibiotic, the second, and so on and so forth. When you isolate Pseudomonas from those people, a very high fraction of them are mutators. Okay. So changing the fraction of mutators in the population is likely to have played a role in real evolution in the real world. I just want to say one more thing about this particular experiment, which is you can try and get a feeling for how much of a boost being a mutator gives you by doing this experiment at different ratios of mutator to wild type. And I think what I've done is I've transposed these all, so these should actually all be down one order of magnitude on this log scale, okay? So if the mutators are 10% of the starting population, they win. If they're 1%, they win. If they're 0.1%, 10 to the minus 3, sometimes they win and sometimes they lose. Now, the mutators, in principle, are only giving you, I mean, we've tried to measure it, and 100-fold the sort of canonical, roughly, value. It seems a little generous in our strength. It's probably less than 100-fold advantage. The fact, therefore, that even at 10 to the minus 3, they're sometimes winning, may say something about the sorts of mutations that are important. So, for example, if mutations were important where you needed to mutate either two things or once, or the first thing is actually not advantageous but is just neutral and you need the second one, then the advantage of the mutator should go is, in the situation where it's two, should go as the square of the mutation frequency and so on and so forth. And again, if experiments like this were done sufficiently carefully, and I will caution you again that they have not thus far been done that way, a lot could probably be learned from that. And that's one of the things we talked to Daniel about doing. Yes.
And so in low glucose, it presumably goes in sooner.
No, it goes in later because the cells grow slower. They reach a lower saturation density, but they grow slower.
But does all this end up just a one-time improvement in awareness, or do they come out of lactate faster?
So one of the things in these experiments, especially things designed to address rather general questions, I mean, this particular line of experimentation has actually been temporarily abandoned in the lab, so the person doing it is actually now doing something else that has nothing to do with evolution. So one of the questions about experiments designed to ask these rather general questions about, you know, mutation frequency, product of effective population size and mutation frequency, is do you want to do molecular analysis on the end of them? So there are other experiments where we're very interested in, you know, what happens to specific modules, and I'll describe one of those. Now, you could argue you should set up experiments where you can get both sorts of information out, and we worry about doing jack of all trades, master of none experiments. So we're probably going to end up doing somewhat separate experiments to ask about these general questions, where we may do rather limited phenotypic and genetic analysis at the end, and then do other experiments where we're much more interested in sort of the cell biology. And for example, we told Botstein that if we did enough of these experiments and he wanted the things that came out of them, because he is interested in what happened in the molecular basis, we'd be happy to give them to him. Oh, sorry, he had his hand up first. Sorry.
Have you done that experiment for different population sizes?
No, we have not. And obviously interesting things could be learned by doing. Yes?
How do you make sure that the triggers don't get rid of their resistance if they are not constantly...
The drug resistance?
Yes.
Well, the painful way we do the experiments now, we could see it happen. We haven't seen it happen. And the drug resistance has to be, the resistance markers have to be, you have to select a locus to integrate them into the genome where you're pretty sure that nothing bad will happen. And the expression of the drug resistance marker is, the protein is probably expressed at a low enough level that it's not really imposing any drag on the cells. So it's not, I mean, in lots of situations with bacterial antibiotic resistance, the things are carried on extra chromosomal plasmids, and if you waited long enough in experiments like this, you would stochastically lose them, but it doesn't happen in our experiments. Yes?
So that's very cool. It seems like potentially there's something right away about modularity that could be investigated. For example, you said yeast don't have a classic Pasteur effect, and so the low glucose, relatively high oxygen environment would be an environment where the Pasteur effect would be advantageous.
Yeah, so mapping...
acquisition of the Pasteur effect, for example, by a transposon in front of the regulators for the frontally loaded pathway, would be a way by which there would be a basically pre-canned modular mechanism by which you would acquire a Pasteur effect.
Yeah.
About that.
No, and now he's going to be geographically closer to us. We will. The Pasteur effect just means that most organisms, if you give them glucose and oxygen, will oxidize the glucose all the way. Okay? And they'll only ferment glucose if they're anoxic, because then you can't oxidize it. And yeast, I don't think it's uniquely an exception, but is one of the relatively small number of organisms that does not have that behavior, which is called the Pasteur effect. And they, if you give them glucose and oxygen, they ferment the sugar. Now, I think
the
ethanol and acetate, ethanol. Right? So they make some of each. Yeah, and I understand what you're saying, and so that's the argument for.
Well, you talk about
transposons. Yeah, absolutely.
Because that would be, that switch isn't a classic Darwinian mechanism, but it's a more of a, it's a regulatory strategy in the low glucose scenario to have a mutable transposon to change your regulatory strategy.
Right. I mean, you could imagine, it's non-Darwinian if it's like Adam's thing where there was an invertible element set up in front of. I mean, I think transposons hopping in okay, so then maybe it was put there.
Put there to do that.
Yeah, yeah. No. None of us should be using the term.
We shouldn't use that term. It's a shorthand.
So. What John is saying is there are the pili situation, there's this elaborate mechanism which itself has been evolved, the thing that Adam talked about, to flip things back and forth. And that strategy has been crafted by selection, so it has some switching rate, and it's designed, in a sense, if you like, to switch things back and forth. You could change the expression of a gene because at random, some other piece of DNA leapt in front of it, which does happen at some very low frequency, and changed the strength of the promoter. That has not in any specific sense been selected for. Okay? Whereas if instead in front of the piece of DNA, you have a piece of DNA that can, by recombination or some other mechanism, flip back and forth, like the case that Adam described, you know, quote unquote, it's like God put it there for a purpose. It's not God put it, who put it there, but it was selected over time to have that structure through some series of gradually improving steps. Whereas the other thing is just like lightning strikes and sometimes, you know, it lights up the sky and it looks pretty instead of killing your dog. Have I helped any? Probably not.
You mean that if it's
relatively poorly tuned mechanism, you call it Darwinian? We just shouldn't use the word Darwinian. There are things that have been selected to promote variation and I think the important thing that John's talking about, at specific genes, like exactly like the thing that Adam talked about, which is a particularly elaborate version. It's genetic, yeah. It's designed to predict, and then there are things where just random mutations produce effects that would be useful. They both are Darwinian in some sense.
Yeah, but it could be that this example of the law of glucose is a thing like Adam talked about.
Right, but it depends on the details. Maybe we could talk about it in the discussion. Can we hold group selection for the discussion too? Because that gets us into long debate. Yes. It exists in the data, but it's what I've drawn there is how a single replicate behaved. The hump existed in the data, and it's certainly probably above the sampling error in the measurements. Yes.
I'm curious about this data right here. I just want to see if I have it clear. You're talking about the rate of evolution, which is proportional to hitting a mutator gene. Our DNA repair gene, for example, increasing the rate of mutation. It's a lot like cancer, if you have models, for example. If you introduce multiple copies of the repair genes, can you slow evolution?
That's an interesting question. So there are two things I would say about that. First of all, it's not clear that introducing multiple copies of any one mismatch repair gene would reduce the mutation frequency. So I don't think, I mean, it's not clear that the technical way of attacking it that you're suggesting would actually work. Although I don't know that. Yeah. And yes, the prediction would be it would slow it down and that those guys would lose relative to wild type. One of the questions that's actually sort of big deal in evolutionary theory, and maybe we can come back to more in the discussion, but I'll introduce it at least when we talk about sex, is how important in non-mutator strains is the steady rain of mildly deleterious mutations. Now, given that I told you that the mutation frequency is 10 to the minus 9, and that the genome size of yeast is 10 to the 7th, the frequency at which you see any base mutated should be about 1 in 100 divisions, and lots of those mutations will be neutral. So at least in yeast, the steady rain of mutations produces a rather modest effect. In organisms that go through more divisions, cell divisions between generations, like people, the effective mutation rate is the intrinsic cell-specific mutation rate multiplied by their number of divisions. And people have attempted to measure this number, and those measurements are really fraught with error, and people have come out with very different numbers. And actually, I guess that maybe that takes us straight into sex. So here's a classical conundrum about sex for organisms which are so-called heterogametic, that is, where only one of the two sexes puts more into the progeny than the other, like ourselves. More mass, okay? Same amount of genetic material, usually. So here is the traditional American family. Now, if you considered the Osbournes, you might get something like this. You know, or survivor, whatever, right? If everyone has two offspring, the population size is stable, right? So, you know, although the particular pattern of mating is not characteristic, you know, Britain, France, Germany, Italy are close to this. Some of them actually do less than replacement at the moment. Right. So now imagine radical feminism has its ultimate triumph. And men are proved to be truly useless. This population increases exponentially, right? So if this mutation arose in this population, it should take over the population, right? So this is called the two. Well, this woman has two, right? So does this woman, right? She just doesn't need the guy. She doesn't have to produce sons in order to produce more offspring. Yeah, these guys, the exponent is higher in this. In this case, the exponent is zero and one here, but it doesn't matter on the family size. These guys, assuming the same number of offspring, this will always take over the population. Okay? Now, what's observed, with a single notable exception that my colleague Matt Messelson works on, the Messelson of Messelson and Stahl, the Deloid rotifers. Rotifers are little aquatic creatures of about a few hundred cells that swim about and eat even smaller creatures. So there are asexual organisms, and they're organisms that sometimes reproduce sexually and sometimes not. But most of the asexual organisms that have existed, that there is evidence for their existence, have been very short-lived. So they're parthenogenetically reproducing fish, and they're parthenogenetically reproducing amphibia. But in all those cases, they have been short-lived. So these mutations probably, as predicted, took over populations. But in the long run, the slings and arrows of environmental fortune did them in. And this is the one exception, because these guys have existed without sex for approximately 35 million years. It appears to be a unique exception. That is, that the other cases that have been advanced, they have diversified. Some, I mean, a lot, some, how do you know? But they have certain, I mean, there is more than one species, right? There are lots of other cases that have been advanced for groups of organisms that have gone as long without sex. All the ones that I know of have been debunked. So this appears probably to be a rare and possibly unique exception. In ASA, it's a very complicated thing to do. We could discuss it if you wanted.
It's fair to say there's no convention. There are different people have different definitions.
Well, the standard definition, I mean, so what Mark's alluding to is that the standard definition, the two things are two different groups of organisms or different species, is that in the wild, and importantly in the wild, not in the laboratory, they do not exchange genetic information with each other. That is, even if they get down and dirty, that does not, which in some cases they do, but the progeny are sterile. There's a block to gene flow between the two species. And as he points out, once you have organisms that don't have sex, every individual by that definition is a species. And so then it becomes, probably you have to say you have an operational definition that it's sequence divergence beyond this. It's either a molecular definition, it's sequence divergence beyond a certain percent, or it's a morphological definition, depending. These guys, oh yeah, they're morphological. I mean, yes, they're. Oh yeah, no, they're absolutely species. I mean, it's a sort of detailed question about, you know, terminology and biology. Okay. So there are three explanations for why sex appears to be this long-term successful strategy. So the first of those. Is the one that you all learned about in high school if you took biology in high school. And if not there in college if you took biology. which is sex is good because you bring together mutations that are wonderful and everyone's happy. I will just point out to you that it can't possibly be that simple because recombination is blind. It doesn't know whether it's putting together good mutations or tearing them asunder. And so, in fact, it's equally good at doing both. Okay? And so this... Well, this depends. This really depends on something called clonal interference, which what I'd rather do is if people want... I can explain what clonal interference is in the discussion rather than doing it now. I mean, so yes, this can be true, but it's not as simple as your high school teacher thought it was. Well, I mean, you know, most people didn't until they got to this stage. It can, you know, be like Donald Rumsfeld. That is, the goal can be to eliminate the bad. And so here are two individuals. They each have three mildly deleterious mutations. What sex can do in this situation, and in the particular case I'm drawing, this would be true a 32nd of the time, it would come out like this. You can get all six of the deleterious mutations in one of the two progeny and none in the other. And if this progeny dies, you've sort of cleaned up the population. Again, it's not as simple as it looks, and it depends on the bad mutations interacting in some sense positively with each other. That's what population geneticists would call synergistic epistasis. It means the fitness of multiple mutants they're worse off than expected from the product of the individual mutations. And again, for this to work, it requires that the frequency of bad mutations be about one per reproducing organism per generation, which is why those measurements about what that frequency really is get to be important. Okay. And the last possibility is it can be about rescuing good mutations from bad genetic neighborhoods. So what I mean by that, and I'm just going to draw a frequency distribution, I shouldn't use n since I'm using that for population size. This is the number of individuals that have some particular fitness. And many populations probably look like this when you draw that graph. Now, in an asexually reproducing organism, if you eliminated any further mutation and you waited enough generation, these guys are going to be the ones who inherit the test tube, right? And these guys will be eliminated. Okay? That's what destiny is. Right? So now imagine that some poor sucker back here in the tail has a mutation that increases fitness, actually a substantial amount, but small relative to the variance of the population or on the order of the variance within the population. This isn't enough, right? And the only good mutations are ones that are close enough to the boundary that separates the nose from the tail, or on the right side of the boundary so that you move like this. So many of the good mutations that you have get eliminated not stochastically, but get eliminated because they happen in bad neighborhoods. And obviously, again, in a sexual population, you know, Project Head Start can rescue you. Now, again, it's important to point out that the reverse can also happen. And this is a situation actually where I don't think the theory has been as well worked out as in some of these other situations. And again, Chin-Ling Guo, physicist who's in the lab, is interested in, and has been playing a little bit with simulation and modeling of this situation. Anyway, those are three separate situations, or three separate mechanisms by which sex could be a good thing. The issue is that
generally there is a second order effect that favors the sex, because on the appropriate kind of average, the gain you get from the binding is more than the loss you get from the recovery.
In this one or in this one?
In the one.
Yeah, no, right, yeah, right, so I'm giving very hand-waving models. I'm just pointing out, if I only drew the arrow going in one direction, I would be lying worse than by drawing both arrows. I'm not trying to imply that anything about the details, or indeed that I know anything about the detail, okay? That's exactly what I was going to say, which is that it seems a little hard to get a factor of two out of these. And at least for some of these things, like this one, the math has been worked through. And to get a factor of two requires that the frequency of deleterious mutations be really quite high, okay? And that the synergy between the mutations be quite strong. But let me just say one other thing. The factor of two comes from the extremely simplistic model I drew. And, you know, sort of annually in Nature or Science, there's a paper arguing about making more complicated models which reduce the cost of sex, okay, below this factor of two, right? And I'm not really competent to critique all those different pieces of work, but they... They make, you know, they do things like they say, well, okay, the environment's subdivided and things like that. And there are all sorts of ways that you can modify the factor from being two. Now, whether that's hocus pocus or it's real, I don't know. Yes?
But if both gender could reproduce, then you could have sex and you would not have a load of sex. So why don't you have that?
That's a good question. I can't, standing here off the top of my head, give you an answer. Yeah, well, you can have, but I think having both sexes reproducing in some sense is the same as having one reproduce. You eliminate all, well, no, but you're saying you have sex as well. Well, at some level, that's what yeast does, right? Okay, so yeah, so there are organisms that do that. There aren't multicellular ones. Well, but then they go through meiosis and they make four. I mean. No, so what I was going to say is, so there are two problems. It's hard for, well, let me put it this way. To the extent these different models have been worked out, for any one of them, the conditions that apply to get a twofold advantage are quite restrictive. That is, only if certain things are true will they give a twofold advantage. So that seems to me to leave three possibilities. Either one, we haven't thought of the right explanation yet. Or two, the cost is less than twofold in the real world. Or three, the correct explanation is not actually any one of these, but some combination of them. And under different circumstances, one of them is dominant and one than another. And it's the combination that makes sure that you can combat the twofold cost. Okay, I'm perfectly happy to buy that. Well, no, but the problem is we can clearly get rid of sex, right? We can get rid of sex, right? I mean, you know, parthenogenetic populations arise, parthenogenetic species arise. No, I mean, you know, you couldn't make, because of imprinting, you could not easily make parthenogenetic people, right? Which is, I'm sure, a source of great disappointment to the Raelians and amongst others. No, I don't think it's true in throughout all of the animal kingdom. It's true in lots of the animal kingdom. Well, most is different from all. I guess the question is, I guess we have three choices at this point. We could start a discussion, you know, about the theories. Okay. So I can tell you what we were planning to do, and we in this case, I'm using the royal we. Well, no, I'm using the imperial, as in, I say we, but someone else did the experiment. So the person who did the experiment is named Dawn Thompson. So what Dawn wanted to do is to try and do something experimentally that would contribute to this. And to be honest, our initial plan has yet to be realized. Our initial plan was to do some very quick experiments to show that sex is truly advantageous in yeast. Having demonstrated that, which we thought would not be particularly surprising, to then use the fact that mutations exist in yeast so that you can fractionate sex into its different stages. And in particular, you can have some aspects of sex but without going through a haploid part of the cell cycle by using appropriate mutations. Or you can still make spores but not do recombination at all. And so you could try and ask which parts of, and you can arrange it so that the cells inbreed, that is, they mate to their close relatives, or they outbreed, they don't. And that we can arrange all those things to be true, and then having shown that sex was advantageous, we could use these things to try and dissect why it was advantageous, and that might be a particularly powerful way of discriminating amongst these models. Sadly, however, it turns out that the initial experiment was much more difficult than we thought. So that, first of all, there were all sorts of technical difficulties. And secondly, it turns out that it's not that easy to find conditions where sex is the better strategy. So let me describe the experiment. So it's very much like the experiment before. You start out with two populations. They're differently genetically marked. But in this case, and so they have drug resistance markers and things, which I'm not listing here. One of them is wild type. It's diploid, so it can sporulate. The other one is identical in every respect, except it can't make spores. Okay, so it's constrained to live forever as a diploid cell, and we do that by knocking out one of the major transcriptional regulators of the gene expression program that induces meiosis. Okay. So the way the experiment's done is you do this, you take your growth condition, whatever it is, you grow the things up, you dilute, and you do that every day. Every so often, and so often can be varied, but it's, you know, roughly, well, it's varied in different experiments between once every 15 and once every 100 reproductive generations. You take the guys and you starve them for nitrogen. And then the two competing strains do different things. The guys that can't sporulate just sit there. The guys that can make spores, you put them back into rich medium. These guys start dividing. These guys talk to each other, make schmooze, and mate. And it turns out, though, in principle, if all things were equal, in terms of numbers, the two strategies should be the same, and so there isn't a twofold cost of sex. Experimentally, if we measure things, when you go through this part of the cycle and you keep track of the two populations, the sexual guys decline by a frequency of about 2, which is to do with the fact that not everyone gets to make spores. And while the cells are mating, they arrest their cell cycle while they're mating, and these guys are busy dividing because diploid cells don't respond to the mating factors. And so during the sexual cycle, these guys get about a twofold leg up. Okay. And there's one other variable. So we could start this experiment as much as possible without any existing genetic variation in the population at the beginning of the experiment, which doesn't probably mimic natural populations very well. Or we could start with some level of existing genetic variation. And we can control that by the fact that yeast cells that are used in the laboratory, somewhat embarrassingly, it seems to me intellectually, are come in a variety of different strain backgrounds, which were derived in very ad hoc ways from natural populations by different people. However, for this experiment, there's an advantage. So we can use diploids where both parents came from the same lab strain, and this is a pink strain and a green strain. We can make diploids where one parent came from each strain. And at least in some cases, those strains differ from each other by about one base pair in 200, which is what these X's are here. So in this experiment, there is pre-existing genetic variation when you start the experiment. In principle, recombination can sort it out and so on and so forth. And these are the results of two different experiments. And this is selection for a weak, or this is weak selection. This is asking cells to grow in glycerol, which they can't ferment, but they have to oxidize, and they don't particularly like doing. And in this case, this is not a log. It's important to point out, this time this is not a logarithmic axis. This is a regular one. And this is the fraction of cells which are of the version that can't make spores, the ones that can't do sex. Okay? And sex occurred where the red S's are. And in this case, there are actually four replicates, but it was too messy to draw all of them here. And this is at least a reasonable caricature of the data. In all four of the cases, it looks like the asexual strain one. That is that this twofold drain each time you went through sex could not be combated by any advantage that sex gave. This is an experiment under a stronger selective condition. And all I mean by strong is how much at the beginning of the experiment you have slowed down the doubling time of the wild-type cells. Right? And this turns out to be growing cells in high salt concentrations. Yeast, not being a marine species, is not particularly happy about having one molar salt in its environment. And so now, unfortunately, there are two things have varied between these experiments. So this is why this is all preliminary, and you shouldn't take any of it too seriously. So now, instead of doing sex three times, we've done it five times, and we've done it at 15-generation intervals instead of 100-generation intervals. So there are at least three variables that have changed between the experiments, so you shouldn't take the difference between them too seriously. And in this case, I've actually tried to draw all seven replicates that Dawn did. And what happened is four of them, the sexual guys won right from the start. So going down to zero here means that the population is predominantly or exclusively made up of guys who can do sex. In one case, it looks like it went the other way for a little bit, and then it came back. In the other two cases, for a long time, it looked like the asexual guys were winning, and then finally it looks like sex came through. And so really, this is just an illustration of the sort of experiments you can do, and now that a lot of the teething troubles have been worked out, we need to do more of, so that hopefully we can get back to the original objective, which is to figure out why it is that sex is helpful in this situation. So do you want to hear about speciation for 10 minutes or quit? Okay. So, speciation is at least something that happens in the real world, so maybe that's something where you could argue that doing things in the lab, there is an equivalent in the real world. There are two mechanisms that have been proposed for speciation. One is called allopatric. Actually, the names don't make much difference. In allopatric population, you start with a population, and one half of it gets to be on one side of some physical barrier. It's a mountain in this diagram, and one gets on the other. And then over time, these populations evolve. And things happen, and traits are selected for. And what ends up happening is that they have just diverged sufficiently that if the mountain washes into the sea, or they migrate around it, there's a barrier to genetic exchange between them. Either they can't mate with each other anymore, or even if they can, their progeny are dead or sterile. Okay? What's called sympatric speciation is harder to make sense of, but there now is some very good evidence from the sort of what happened in late Victorian, for example, with the cichlids. There's pretty good evidence has really happened in the real world. And in this situation, you have an ancestral population. And without geographic separation, it splits into two subpopulations that are genetically different from each other in some way. And as a result of that split, although these can still mate with each other, their progeny are not as fit as matings within those populations would be. And if that disadvantage is strong enough, you select for mutations in the two subpopulations such that eventually you have what, according to the conventional definition of species, that is two populations that are as a result of isolation, either that prevents mating or prevents the formation of reproductively capable progeny, blocks the exchange of genetic information between those two populations. And so I'll give you a cartoon of what happens, and the cartoon and the hard work and a lot of the thinking here is provided by Jin-Yi Liu, who's a postdoc in the lab. So these lollipops are trees, and the bow ties are butterflies. There are a lot of green butterflies, there are a lot of green trees. The butterflies are in competition with each other for food, and some of the trees are blue. So you can make, by mutation, a blue butterfly. And the blue butterfly has an advantage because the blue trees aren't being exploited. So now you have a population. Sorry. Where green and blue butterflies could mate with each other. And imagine, for the sake of argument, that the result of that mating is a butterfly where with one green and one blue wing, okay? Which can thus not be camouflaged on either sort of tree, gets eaten by birds and so on and so forth. So now there is selection for a second type of mutation. So in Jin-Yi's little cartoon, this says, initially it says sex, which is what butterflies think about all the time. And the second mutation adds a qualification to that. Think blue. That is, pick blue butterflies to mate with, because then blue butterflies mate with each other to make blue progeny, green butterflies mate with each other to make green progeny, and you don't make any of these guys. Okay? So that's a sort of helpful to think about it explanation of a scenario for sympatric speciation. So what he wanted to do is to see if he could do that in the lab. So the experiment is at least conceptually simple. It took a great deal of genetic engineering to put in all the bells and whistles that are prepared to make this work. And again, the one thing I would say for anyone who's interested in doing experiments like this, you will get what you select for, okay? That means, if you select for growth on low glucose, you will get things that grow better on low glucose. As Mark pointed out, if you select for things that grow better in some environment in a chemostat, you have to work hard to avoid for selecting for cells that like to stick to the side of the chemostat. This experiment uses a great many different sorts of genetic tricks to select for and against particular things, and you better make sure that all of those are really robust so you don't get things that are uninteresting and that you didn't wish to find. So the way it works is there are two populations. One is white and one is red in this diagram. They're derived from the same strain background, and they only differ from each other by possession of a series of genetic bells and whistles. Okay, so there's no intrinsic preference when the experiment begins and we check for the red cells to mate with each other as opposed to the white cells or vice versa. You take a minority of the white cells and a majority of the red cells, this is actually a 1-to-10 ratio, and you mate them together. So just statistically, this is the least frequent class in the population. Most of the white cells mate to red cells, and by far the largest class of the population is red cells that have mated with each other. The red cells contain genetic markers that allow us to put them to the sword. So they're killed by experimental interference. That leaves the product of white cells that have mated to each other, and these cells have, the A's and alphas have different markers which are linked to the mating type locus, so we select for diploids as opposed to haploids that haven't mated with anybody. We allow them to sporulate, having amplified the population. And then, again, using genetic bells and whistles, we allow them to germinate, but we have conditions where only the A cells survive when they germinate and only the alpha cells survive when they germinate, because we have to keep these from mating to each other while they're germinating so we can reconfront them with the red cell. And then you just go round the clock. And so this takes about 2 weeks to go round this, because even though the generation time is only 90 minutes, it takes about a week to go through the standard life cycle, and we do some amplification, and doing things on mass doesn't work quite as well as optimal conditions, so this is quite slow. So we then do two things. We measure the mating preference, that is, the fraction of the white guys that mate with each other as opposed to the red cells. And we measure the mating efficiency, the fraction of the input white guys who mate to anyone, be it white or be it red. Okay. And so these, no, hopefully not. So these guys, for example, they have a dominant allele. Oh, I've forgotten the. They have a dominant allele of a sporulation gene that prevents them from sporulating. So even if you mate diploids, they can't sporulate. And they have. A non-degradable version of a cohesin, which is a protein that's involved in holding the sister chromatid together, which has to be cut in half in order for the chromosomes to separate at mitosis. And if you make a version that can't be cut, you can't separate the chromosomes and you kill the cells. So those are things that are used to kill the cells. So actually, we hope it doesn't make any difference. That is, we just have ways of killing anyone who's red. No, we're looking for how fast the white cells can gain mutation so that they can sense the difference between white and red. Well, that's what I was referring to before, is when you start experiments like this, you better be careful. So that the reason they're two different things in the red cells to kill them is that you could lose one, and then the red cells could survive, and you could lose the other. Well, so if you only had one, you could lose one and they could survive. If you have both, they have to lose both of them. In reality, I mean, he started out with 40 independent parallel cultures. About 40% of those have been lost, not because of carelessness, but because one of the markers disappeared in such a way that the experiment got screwed up. So even with a lot of thought and effort, we didn't make our defenses perfect. Okay. So this is the outcome of that experiment. This is the mating preference. So so there are lots of cultures. This is the best sort of example. There are some that have only gone up like this, and the mean is probably something like that. So we've evolved a substantial mating preference, and it's not been that the cells just mate more efficiently, because actually the mating efficiency as defined in this assay has gone down somewhat. Yeah, each cycle is going all the way around. So this is something of a, I mean, this is more like an experiment, in traditional experiment in physics in some sense than in biology. I mean, it's not like come in, do the experiment, and decide you designed it wrong and go back the next day and redesign it and do it again. Perhaps the best measurement is the one that's shown here, where you take a minority of one of the two mating types, and I've drawn it as being A's here, and you confront it with a tenfold excess of alpha cells, which are equally derived from the two populations. So now each one of these cells should be surrounded by several cells of the opposite mating type drawn randomly from the two populations. It's not, I mean, this is a population mixing experiment. It's not neatly geometrically done the way I've drawn it. And you measure the fraction of the time they mate with one as opposed to the other. And so the important control is, and so you do it either with the strain that's allowed to evolve, the white strain, or the strain that's not allowed to evolve, the red strain. And the other thing is that the red strain is taken out of the freezer fresh in each cycle because we don't want it to evolve. And the other little detail is that this is a mutator strain because we like to get somewhere before Jenny gets gray hair. And so at the beginning of the experiment, whether the cell in the center is white or red, it's random which of the two cells it mates with, at least within the standard error of the measurement. Okay? After the population's been evolved, the white cells have a fivefold preference to mate with other white cells, other evolved white cells, as opposed to red cells. And the red cells have a preference to mate to red cells rather than white cells. And this is really crucial, because it tells you that it's not just that the white cells somehow got sexier, right? Because the red cells actually discriminate against them. Okay? And so this is where we are, and the thing to do now is to try and track down the mutation, figure out what happened, and in particular to ask, is what happened in different experiments the same? There are some very preliminary experiments have been done towards the latter end, because you can do genetic tricks that don't require tracking down the mutations to ask whether what happened in populations was dramatically different from each other in terms of the genes that got mutated or not. And the preliminary evidence is it looks a little bit like the pathways are certainly physiologically in some sense similar, and they may actually be genetically similar, but you should take that as being exceedingly preliminary.
Evolved it several times, right?
Well, I mean, in parallel, yes.
So, have you tried if the white guy that was evolved in one run also likes better the white guy from other runs?
Yeah, that's the experiment that suggests that the physiological mechanism may well be the same. So, we've done that experiment. We've taken white A's from culture 42 and white alphas from culture 39, and we've mixed them together, and we've asked how well they mate with each other, and they mate with how well they do this discrimination assay. And the discrimination, I mean, you know, it hasn't been done carefully enough to know that the numbers are, whether they're statistically significantly different or not, but they're, you know, just, you know, hand waving, they're pretty similar to each other. If the mechanisms were very different, you might expect situations where either the discrimination was much higher, that is, they were in some sense additive, or it was zero because they were different, and the fact that it looks about the same is at least a hint that the physiological mechanism might be the same, but a hint only. Now we evolved the white cells. So if the white cells just got very potent at mating, you could get at least some increase in the mating efficiency. Right? And in particular, if they were potent in a way where two potent cells preferred to mate with two potent cells as opposed to a less potent cell, and there's actually evidence that's true from experiments done by Lee Hartwell and his colleagues, we could just have pumped up mating potency. If that was true, the ancestral red cells should prefer to mate with these super sexy cells that we would have evolved. And what this value down here demonstrates is that's clearly not true. That is that the red cells that haven't been evolved, although they can't tell difference between red and unevolved white cells, are fourfold more likely to mate with other red cells than they are to mate with white cells that have been evolved. So that the white cells, in some sense, have become less sexy to the red cells. That's a much more complicated experiment because they have the same genetic marker, so we have to put in new genetic markers, but that's obviously an important thing to do. Yeah. In principle, since at the beginning the things can't discriminate from each other, they come from exactly the same genetic background. I mean, they only differ by these markers that have been put in by transformation. The strong expectation is that the unevolved white cells will look like the red cells, but it's an important control that needs to be done and has not yet been. Yes. Well, I'll just point out one interesting thing about this experiment, which is when a mutation initially happens, here's a mutant cell, right? And it wants to mate to someone who looks like it, but when there's just this one cell, there's no one to mate to. And in particular, so what lots of people say, oh, this is easy, you'll make mutations in the pheromones and the pheromone receptors, okay? But all I would point out is that that has to be a two-hit process. You have to make one mutation in the pheromone and the other in the pheromone receptor, and until both mutations have occurred, you don't have any advantage. Now, it's possible that things like that happen in evolution, that two mutations that individually would either be neutral or even slightly deleterious, when they come together, can give a strong advantage. And it's something that Daniel and I debate on a regular basis, how important that's likely to have been in evolution. But my guess is that there's probably some strong selection for mutations that can recognize each other. So that, for example, if you got a mutation that increased this star, increased the probability that you would adhere to another cell that had the star, that is, a mutation in some cell surface protein that affected binding, that as a one-hit mechanism gives you an advantage. But again, in the beginning, those cells are in very low frequency in the population. I mean, it will be interesting to see how this worked, and I will bet a bottle of beer to anyone that the primary event was not mutation of the pheromones and the pheromone receptors that affected their specificity. Yes, we've done about halfway up the hill here. We took things and we did a standard genetic cross to ask how many. Well, at least to eliminate the possibility that so far we'd only mutated one locus, and that's not true. How many it is unclear. We should stop there. Thanks.